Chapter 17. It's looking bad for Chris. For a while he was way ahead of me, and now he sits under a tree and rests. He doesn't look at me, and that's how I know it's bad. I sit down next to him, and his expression is distant. His face is flushed, and I can see he's exhausted. We sit and listen to the wind through the pines. I know eventually he'll get up and keep going, but he doesn't know this and is afraid to face the possibility that his fear creates, that he may not be able to climb the mountain at all. I remember something Phaedrus had written about these mountains and tell it to Chris now. Years ago, I tell him, your mother and I were at the timberline not so far from here, and we camped near a lake with a marsh on one side. He doesn't look up, but he's listening. At about dawn, we heard falling rocks, and we thought it must be an animal, except that animals don't usually clatter around. Then I heard a squishing sound in the marsh, and we were really wide awake. I got out of the sleeping bag slowly, and got our revolver from my jacket and crouched by a tree. Now Chris's attention is distracted from his own problems. There was another squish, I say. I thought it could be horses with dudes packing in, but not at this hour. Another squish. And a loud galumph. That's no horse. And a galumph. And a galumph. And there, in the dim gray light of dawn, coming straight for me through the muck of the marsh, was the biggest bull moose I ever saw. Horns as wide as a man is tall. Next to the grizzly, the most dangerous animal in the mountains. Some say the worst. Chris's eyes are bright again. Galumph! I cocked the hammer on the revolver, thinking a .38 special wasn't very much for a moose. Galumph! He didn't see me. Galumph! I couldn't get out of his way. Your mother was in the sleeping bag right in his path. Galumph! What a giant! Galumph! He's 10 yards away. Galumph! I stand up and take aim. Galumph! 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 He stops, 3 yards away, and sees me. The gun sights lie right between his eyes. We're motionless. I reach around into my pack and get out some cheese. Then what happened? Chris asks. Wait until I cut off some of this cheese. I remove my hunting knife and hold the cheese wrapper so that my fingers don't get on it. I slice out a 1/4-inch hunk and hold it out for him. He takes it. Then what happened? I watch until he takes his first bite. That bull moose looked at me for what must have been 5 seconds. Then he looked down at your mother. Then he looked at me again, and at the revolver which was practically lying on top of his big round nose. And then he smiled and slowly walked away. Oh, says Chris. He looks disappointed. Normally when they're confronted like that, they'll charge, I say. But he just thought it was a nice morning, and we were there first, so why make trouble? And that's why he smiled. Can they smile? No, but it looked that way. I put the cheese away and add, later on that day we were jumping from boulder to boulder down the side of a slope. I was about to land on a great big brown boulder, when all of a sudden the great big brown boulder jumped into the air and ran off into the woods. It was the same moose. I think that moose must have been pretty sick of us that day. I help Chris get to his feet. You were going a little too fast, I say. Now the mountainside's becoming steep, and we have to go slowly. If you go too fast, you get winded. And when you get winded, you get dizzy, and that weakens your spirit, and you think, I can't do it. So go slow for a while. I'll stay behind you, he says. Okay. We walk now away from the stream we were following, up the canyon side at the shallowest angle I can find. Mountains should be climbed with as little effort as possible, and without desire. The reality of your own nature should determine the speed. If you become restless, speed up. If you become winded, slow down. You climb the mountain in an equilibrium between restlessness and exhaustion. Then, when you're no longer thinking ahead, each footstep isn't just a means to an end, but a unique event in itself. This leaf has jagged edges. This rock looks loose. From this place, the snow is less visible, even though closer. These are things you should notice anyway. To live only for some future goal is shallow. It's the sides of the mountain which sustain life, not the top. Here's where things grow. But of course, without the top, you can't have any sides. It's the top that defines the sides. So on we go. We have a long way, no hurry, just one step after the next, with a little Chautauqua for entertainment. Mental reflection is so much more interesting than TV, it's a shame more people don't switch over to it. They probably think what they hear is unimportant, but it never is. There's a large fragment concerning Phaedrus's first class after he gave that assignment on what is quality in thought and statement. The atmosphere was explosive. Almost everyone seemed as frustrated and angered as he had been by the question. "How are we supposed to know what quality is?" they said. "You're supposed to tell us." Then he told them he couldn't figure it out either, and really wanted to know. He had assigned it in the hope that somebody would come up with a good answer. That ignited it. A roar of indignation shook the room. Before the commotion had settled down, another teacher had stuck his head in the door to see what the trouble was. "It's all right," Phaedrus said. "We just accidentally stumbled over a genuine question, and the shock is hard to recover from." Some students looked curious at this, and the noise simmered down. He then used the occasion for a short return to his theme of corruption and decay in the Church of Reason. It was a measure of this corruption, he said, that students should be outraged by someone trying to use them to seek the truth. You were supposed to fake this search for the truth, to imitate it. To actually search for it was a damned imposition. The truth was, he said, that he genuinely did want to know what they thought, not so that he could put a grade on it, but because he really wanted to know. They looked puzzled. "I sat there all night long," one said. "I was ready to cry, I was so mad," a girl next to the window said. "You should warn us," a third said. "How could I warn you," he said, "when I had no idea how you'd react?" Some of the puzzled ones looked at him with a first dawning. He wasn't playing games. He really wanted to know. A most peculiar person. Then someone said, "What do you think?" "I don't know," he answered. "But what do you think?" He paused for a long time. "I think there is such a thing as quality, but that as soon as you try to define it, something goes haywire. You can't do it." Murmurs of agreement. He continued. "Why this is, I don't know. I thought maybe I'd get some ideas from your papers. I just don't know." This time the class was silent. In subsequent classes that day, there was some of the same commotion, but a number of the students in each class volunteered friendly answers that told him the first class had been discussed during lunch. A few days later, he worked up a definition of his own and put it on the blackboard to be copied for posterity. The definition was, "Quality is a characteristic of thought and statement that is recognized by a non-thinking process. Because definitions are a product of rigid, formal thinking, quality cannot be defined." The fact that this definition was actually a refusal to define did not draw comment. The students had no formal training that would have told them his statement was, in a formal sense, completely irrational. If you can't define something, you have no formal rational way of knowing that it exists. Neither can you really tell anyone what it is. There is, in fact, no formal difference between inability to define and stupidity. When I say quality cannot be defined, I'm really saying formally, I'm stupid about quality. Fortunately, the students didn't know this. If they'd come up with these objections, he wouldn't have been able to answer them at the time. But then, below the definition on the blackboard, he wrote, "But even though quality cannot be defined, you know what quality is." And the storm started all over again. "Oh, no, we don't." "Oh, yes, you do." "Oh, no, we don't." "Oh, yes, you do," he said. And he had some material ready to demonstrate it to them. He had selected two examples of student composition. The first was a rambling, disconnected thing with interesting ideas that never built into anything. The second was a magnificent piece by a student who was mystified himself about why it had come out so well. Phaedrus read both, then asked for a show of hands on who thought the first was best. Two hands went up. He asked how many liked the second better. 28 hands went up. "Whatever it is," he said, "that caused the overwhelming majority to raise their hands for the second one is what I mean by quality. So you know what it is." There was a long reflective silence after this, and he just let it last. This was just intellectually outrageous, and he knew it. He wasn't teaching anymore, he was indoctrinating. He had erected an imaginary entity, defined it as incapable of definition, told the students over their own protests that they knew what it was, and demonstrated this by a technique that was as confusing logically as the term itself. He was able to get away with this because logical refutation required more talent than any of the students had. In subsequent days, he continually invited their refutations, but none came. He improvised further. To reinforce the idea that they already knew what quality was, he developed a routine in which he read 4 student papers in class and had everyone rank them in estimated order of quality on a slip of paper. He did the same himself. He collected the slips, tallied them on the blackboard, and averaged the rankings for an overall class opinion. Then he would reveal his own rankings, and this would almost always be close to, if not identical with, the class average. Where there were differences, it was usually because 2 papers were close in quality. At first, the classes were excited by this exercise, but as time went on, they became bored. What he meant by quality was obvious. They obviously knew what it was, too, and so they lost interest in listening. Their question now was, "All right, we know what quality is. How do we get it?" Now, at last, the standard rhetoric texts came into their own. The principles expounded in them were no longer rules to rebel against, not ultimates in themselves, but just techniques, gimmicks, for producing what really counted and stood independently of the techniques. Quality. What had started out as a heresy from traditional rhetoric turned into a beautiful introduction to it. He singled out aspects of quality such as unity, vividness, authority, economy, sensitivity, clarity, emphasis, flow, suspense, brilliance, precision, proportion, depth, and so on. Kept each of these as poorly defined as quality itself, but demonstrated them by the same class reading techniques. He showed how the aspect of quality called unity, the hanging togetherness of a story, could be improved with a technique called an outline. The authority of an argument could be jacked up with a technique called footnotes, which gives authoritative reference. Outlines and footnotes are standard things taught in all freshman composition classes, but now as devices for improving quality, they had a purpose. And if a student turned in a bunch of dumb references or a sloppy outline that showed he was just fulfilling an assignment by rote, he could be told that while his paper may have fulfilled the letter of the assignment, it obviously didn't fulfill the goal of quality, and was therefore worthless. Now, in answer to that eternal student question, "How do I do this?" that had frustrated him to the point of resignation, he could reply, "It doesn't make a bit of difference how you do it, just so it's good." The reluctant student might ask in class, "But how do we know what's good?" But almost before the question was out of his mouth, he would realize the answer had already been supplied. Some other student would usually tell him, "You just see it." If he said, "No, I don't," he'd be told, "Yes, you do. He proved it." The student was finally and completely trapped into making quality judgments for himself. And it was just exactly this and nothing else that taught him to write. Up to now, Phaedrus had been compelled by the academic system to say what he wanted, even though he knew that this forced students to conform to artificial forms that destroyed their own creativity. Students who went along with his rules were then condemned for their inability to be creative or produce a piece of work that reflected their own personal standards of what is good. Now that was over with. By reversing a basic rule that all things which are to be taught must first be defined, he had found a way out of all this. He was pointing to no principle, no rule of good writing, no theory, but he was pointing to something, nevertheless, that was very real, whose reality they couldn't deny. The vacuum that had been created by the withholding of grades was suddenly filled with the positive goal of quality, and the whole thing fit together. Students, astonished, came by his office and said, "I used to just hate English. Now I spend more time on it than anything else." Not just one or two, many. The whole quality concept was beautiful. It worked. It was that mysterious individual internal goal of each creative person on the blackboard at last. I turn to see how Chris is doing. His face looks tired. I ask, "How do you feel?" "Okay," he says, but his tone is defiant. "We can stop anywhere in camp," I say. He flashes a fierce look at me, and so I say nothing more. Soon I see he's working his way around me on the slope. With what must be great effort, he pulls ahead. We go on. Phaedrus got this far with his concept of quality because he deliberately refused to look outside the immediate classroom experience. Cromwell's statement, "No one ever travels so high as he knows not where he is going," applied at this point. He didn't know where he was going. All he knew was that it worked. In time, however, he wondered why it worked, especially when he already knew it was irrational. Why should an irrational method work when rational methods were also rotten? He had an intuitive feeling, growing rapidly, that what he had stumbled on was no small gimmick. It went far beyond. How far, he didn't know. This was the beginning of the crystallization that I talked about before. Others wondered at the time, why should he get so excited about quality? But they saw only the word and its rhetoric context. They didn't see his past despair over abstract questions of existence itself that he had abandoned in defeat. If anyone else had asked, "What is quality?" it would have been just another question. But when he asked it, because of his past, it spread out for him like waves in all directions simultaneously. Not in a hierarchic structure, but in a concentric one. At the center, generating the waves, was quality. As these waves of thought expanded for him, I'm sure he fully expected each wave to reach some shore of existing patterns of thought, so that he had a kind of unified relationship with these thought structures. But the shore was never reached until the end, if it appeared at all. For him, there was nothing but ever-expanding waves of crystallization. I'll now try to follow these waves of crystallization, the second phase of his exploration into quality, as best I can. His movements seem tired and angry. He stumbles on things, lets branches tear at him, instead of pulling them to one side.
I'm sorry to see this. Some blame can be put on the YMCA camp he attended for 2 weeks just before we started. From what he's told me, they make a big ego thing out of the whole outdoor experience. A proof of manhood thing. He began in a lowly class they were careful to point out was rather disgraceful to be in. Original sin. Then he was allowed to prove himself with a long series of accomplishments. Swimming, rope tying. He mentioned a dozen of them, but I've forgotten them. It made the kids at camp much more enthusiastic and cooperative when they had ego goals to fulfill, I'm sure. But ultimately, that kind of motivation is destructive. Any effort that has self-glorification as its final endpoint is bound to end in disaster. Now we're paying the price. When you try to climb a mountain to prove how big you are, you almost never make it. And even if you do, it's a hollow victory. In order to sustain the victory, you have to prove yourself again and again in some other way. And again and again and again, driven forever to fill a false image, haunted by the fear that the image is not true, and someone will find out. That's never the way. Phaedrus wrote a letter from India about a pilgrimage to Holy Mount Kailas, the source of the Ganges, and the abode of Shiva, high in the Himalayas, in the company of a holy man and his adherents. He never reached the mountain. After the third day, he gave up, exhausted, and the pilgrimage went on without him. He said he had the physical strength, but that physical strength wasn't enough. He had the intellectual motivation, but that wasn't enough either. He didn't think he had been arrogant, but thought that he was undertaking the pilgrimage to broaden his experience, to gain understanding for himself. He was trying to use the mountain for his own purposes, and the pilgrimage too. He regarded himself as the fixed entity, not the pilgrimage or the mountain, and thus wasn't ready for it. He speculated that the other pilgrims, the ones who reached the mountain, probably sensed the holiness of the mountain so intensely that each footstep was an act of devotion, an act of submission to this holiness. The holiness of the mountain infused into their own spirits enabled them to endure far more than anything he, with his greater physical strength, could take. To the untrained eye, ego climbing and selfless climbing may appear identical. Both kinds of climbers place one foot in front of the other. Both breathe in and out at the same rate. Both stop when tired. Both go forward when rested. But what a difference! The ego climber is like an instrument that's out of adjustment. He puts his foot down an instant too soon or too late. He's likely to miss a beautiful passage of sunlight through the trees. He goes on when the sloppiness of his step shows he's tired. He rests at odd times. He looks up the trail trying to see what's ahead, even when he knows what's ahead, because he just looked a second before. He goes too fast or too slow for the conditions, and when he talks, his talk is forever about somewhere else, something else. He's here, but he's not here. He rejects the here, is unhappy with it, wants to be farther up the trail, but when he gets there, will be just as unhappy because then it will be here. What he's looking for, what he wants, is all around him. But he doesn't want that because it is all around him. Every step's an effort, both physically and spiritually, because he imagines his goal to be external and distant. That seems to be Chris's problem now.